Kyrsten Sinema, Democratic senator from Arizona, has been on quite a political journey. It begins in the year 2000, working on Ralph Nader's presidential campaign. She was an activist, a progressive, a Green Party candidate for local government, remembered for marching against the Iraq War in a pink tutu. Here she is from those early days on local radio with a call to action.
Democrats, Republicans, Greens, Independents, Anarchists, Socialists, Communists, whoever wants to come, they're all welcome tomorrow.
Fast forward to March 2021. She's a United States Senator, a Democrat. Her brand is bipartisanship, bipartisanship, bipartisanship. Her party has won the White House and the House and has only the slimmest of majorities in the Senate. And the Senate is voting on whether to include a $15 minimum wage in the coronavirus relief package. Sinema fought hard for raising the minimum wage in the past, but in a moment that went viral, again in March 2021, she walks to the Senate well and...
Miss Sinema. No.
She gives the $15 federal minimum wage a thumbs down. Then there's the filibuster. When Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell says his mission is to block the entirety of the Biden agenda, that leads many Democrats calling to end the filibuster. But Senator Sinema is not one of them.
To those who say we must make a choice between the filibuster and X, I say this is a false choice. The reality is that when you have a system that's not working effectively, and I would think that most would agree that the Senate's not a particularly well-oiled machine, right? The way to fix that is to change your behavior. Not to eliminate the rules or change the rules, but to change your behavior.
Well, the fault lines are beginning to show. Earlier this month, President Joe Biden all but directly named Sinema and Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia as major roadblocks to advancing his ambitious agenda.
I hear all the folks on TV saying, why doesn't Biden get this done? Well, because Biden only has a majority of effectively four votes in the House and a tie in the Senate with two members of the Senate who vote more with my Republican friends.
Back home, Arizonans who placed their hopes in Sinema are mad. They call her, quote, missing in action when she didn't show up for a vote on forming a commission to investigate the January 6th insurrection on Congress. Former supporters showed up outside her Phoenix office in protest, just as she would have once done.
We campaigned door to door for her, but I won't do it again.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point, and today we're going to look even more deeply into that long journey to understand the past, the present, and the current politics of Arizona Senator Kyrsten Sinema. And joining me to do that is Ron Hansen. He's with us from Phoenix. He covers Congress and state politics for the Arizona Republic and AZ Central. He's also co-host of the podcast The Gaggle. Ron, welcome to you.
Hi, Meghna. Thanks for having me.
So first of all, let me tell you, the Gaggle podcast is excellent. So anyone who's really interested in listening to more detail about Arizona politics, I'm going to point you to Ron's podcast, The Gaggle. It's very, very well done, Ron. But first and foremost, I want to play a moment from Sinema's later time in the Arizona State House. This is about 2010. And back then, Kyrsten Sinema was far more explicitly progressive because, for example, Arizona had just passed what was then the country's most restrictive anti-immigrant law. This is 2010. And she spoke out about it. Here she was at the Netroots Nation Conference in Las Vegas on the radio show The Uptake.
For people looking inside, for outside into Arizona, we look and see this immigration law that got passed, and we say, how the heck did that happen?
Yeah, well, the first thing I think that folks should know is that this was not new. This is not a surprise. This growing anti-immigrant sentiment has been a strategy on the part of the right for many years in Arizona. And I guess my message to folks around the nation would be to pay attention to what's happening in your state. Look at the messaging that's being used and be careful. Because if you're laying down on the job, then your state could turn into Arizona pretty quickly.
Ron Hansen, how much of the Senator Kyrsten Sinema of 2021 do you recognize in that state legislator from 2010?
That's a really good question, and it's a tough one to answer. There's a lot about her that I recognize. There's also a very critical elements of what is happening in Washington that really sort of runs afoul of her earlier years in the legislature. And that moment that you just isolated is sort of a part of when this pivot was happening on issues that, you know, were being handled at the state level, but had clearly a federal nexus to them as well. So it is a tough thing to reconcile, especially if you don't know the fuller story.
Okay, so let's look back a couple of years prior to 2010 then to start fleshing out that fuller story. How would you describe what kind of state legislator Kyrsten Sinema was in the Arizona State House?
Yeah, you know, if I could even go back a little bit earlier than that, she ran in 2002 for the Arizona legislature and lost. She was aligned with the Green Party at the time and was a vocal member of the anti-war movement here in Arizona during the Bush era. And so when she gets to the legislature, she really had sort of created a body of support among the very progressive community in Arizona, such as it was at that time, and found herself in a legislature that has been, to this day, pretty well dominated by Republicans. So she was, in some ways, notable just by her background walking into the place. And by the time she left it, I think she was seen as somebody who was interested in crafting deals to make, legislation that could work. It's worth noting, though, that in Arizona, the legislature really never accepted much Democratic input. Mm. And so, Democrats were always sort of shunted to the back and just sort of watched their legislative goals crumble in a GOP-controlled House and Senate. So she was trying to work productively with people in the very, very limited space where it was permitted.
Okay, so let's talk more about that. But just to give listeners some dates here to frame this conversation, Kyrsten Sinema was first elected to the Arizona House of Representatives in 2005. She served 6 years there and then was elected to the Arizona State Senate and served from 2011 to 2012. Then moved to the United States Congress, first as a House member and now, of course, as a senator here. So we've got quite a bit of time to look back on in terms of her political career. But regarding those early years in the House, that 2005 to 2011 period in the Arizona House, Ron, you just said that Democrats really weren't given much traction in a Republican-controlled state House. So yet you said she tried to work with Arizona Republicans. I mean, tell me more about that. Was she more explicitly progressive, explicitly Democratic, but still tried to find common ground?
I think that's always been a through line for her, is that there is this search for common ground. She, especially in her later years in the state house, was trying to work with person by the name of Russell Pierce, who your listeners may be familiar with. He's the one who was associated with a number of different immigration restrictions enacted at the state level, most notably with Senate Bill 1070, which was an immigration enforcement law that went to the Supreme Court. She was not in favor of 1070, but she did try and find some common ground with Russell Pierce. And that was something that was an irritant to her progressive supporters even then, that there was sort of some dismay that you would even legitimize working with someone as viewed as so hostile to some of the folks who are the bedrock of your Democratic base. And, this is something that I think was understood to be at least somewhat political in its nature, that she wanted to be able to craft an image that showed her as not just the person who was the anti-war activist back in the day, but someone who is a productive legislator willing to work with anybody.
From the start. Okay, interesting. So we're going to come back to this in a second. But I wonder if we can just spend a minute, Ron, and have you help us understand sort of who she is as a person. Now, I want to note that I am always extremely cautious in trying to measure anything about a person by, you know, how they present themselves through dress, et cetera, especially when it comes to women. I think there's too much attention paid to that. But it should be noted that lots of people look at Kyrsten Sinema's sort of public presentation and want to know a little bit more about, you know, about the character of the woman behind it. So can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, and she really is an interesting person because there are some interesting paradoxes that we've seen in Washington that sort of, I think, amplify some of the questions that people have about her here in Arizona and have throughout the years. She was born in 1976 in Tucson. Her parents divorced when she was a child, and her mother moved her and her siblings to the Florida Panhandle for a few years. That's when, in the mid-1980s, they famously spent 3 years living out of an abandoned gas station. She graduated from high school early and with honors. She won a scholarship to Brigham Young University and, again, graduated early and began a career in social work with the Phoenix Area Public School District in the mid-1990s. It's notable that shortly after that, she began pursuing advanced degrees, and she may have the most college degrees in the Senate. She has a master's in social work, a law degree, a PhD in justice studies, and an MBA. So she has a long career in seeking and getting college degrees as well. And all of this, I think, has just kind of garnished her reputation as someone who is a thinker trying to understand more about the world around her.
Ron Hansen covers Congress and state politics for the Arizona Republic and AZ Central. Stand by. There is a lot more we want to learn about Senator Kyrsten Sinema when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. And today we are trying to understand the life story and political journey of Arizona's Democratic Senator Kyrsten Sinema. I'm joined today by Ron Hansen. He covers Congress and state politics for the Arizona Republic and AZ Central as well. Co-host of the podcast The Gaggle, a podcast about Arizona politics. Now, let's just listen to a moment from a campaign ad that Sinema ran in 2012. This came after 7 years in the Arizona State House. She announced that she was running for the House of Representatives in Washington. And here in this ad, viewers saw the faces of mostly older white men, such as Newt Gingrich, Rush Limbaugh, and the former Senator John McCain. Today, of course, Senator Sinema cannot say enough good things about Senator McCain. But in this ad, these faces scroll by the screen, and she says,
"These guys don't get it. They're more focused on dictating women's personal health care decisions, like birth control, than getting our economy back on track. I'll bring people together and work with both parties without sacrificing my progressive values, like I did when I took on Governor Brewer to stop cuts in local schools and protect children's health care. I'm Kyrsten Sinema. I sponsor this ad because the only way to change Washington is to change the people we send there."
A campaign ad from Kyrsten Sinema for her House campaign in 2012. Well, I'm joined now by Kent Burbank. He's with us from Tucson. He's chair of the LGBTQ Plus Alliance Fund of the Community Foundation for Southern Arizona. And he worked with Kyrsten Sinema from 2006 to 2007 as a part of a group called Arizona Together, who were attempting to fight Proposition 107 back then, a ballot proposal that sought to ban gay marriage in Arizona. Kent Burbank, welcome to you.
Thank you. Hello. It's nice to be on your show.
So you heard Ryan Hansen there describe a little bit about Kyrsten Sinema's early life, her admirable, extremely admirable education. Tell us about what kind of person she was when you first began working with her again in sort of the early 2006, 2007 period.
Sure. Yeah. So I found Kyrsten Sinema at that point to be kind of in a transition period where her reputation was one of being a kind of firebrand progressive. I found her to be brilliant, very politically savvy, shrewd. She's also, as you know, a little bit larger than life. And so she's fun. She's charismatic and dynamic. In our work together, it was not without challenges. We were working at a statewide coalition to try to defeat a anti-marriage equality proposition that would have changed the Arizona Constitution.
Okay. Wait, so when you say sometimes, first of all, just larger than life, can you describe what you mean?
She is full of energy. Kyrsten Sinema can be, as I think other people know, a little theatrical. She's very intentional about her image and her presentation and uses that. And again, as you were mentioning, we don't want to get into talking about her appearance, but at the same time, I think she's very aware of her appearance and how she comes across and how she uses that.
Mm, okay. So then tell me more specifically about the work the two of you did together. What brought Sinema into the efforts to fight Proposition 107?
Yeah, so she was one of the co-chairs, along with a man named Steve May, forming the statewide coalition called Arizona Together with the goal of defeating this proposition. As part of forming a statewide coalition, I, at that point, was the director of a LGBTQ community center in Tucson. And we were actually the largest, in terms of staff and budget, LGBTQ organization in the state. But we're not a political. We were a community center doing a lot of social services type of work. I'm a social worker. And so we were working together to try to defeat this. Early on, there was an agreement that we would be trying to really make this a data-driven campaign. And later that became a pretty big source of contention among, well, particularly between the folks in Phoenix, Kyrsten and Steve running the campaign, and the folks in Tucson. There are large differences in the state. Phoenix is obviously the capital. It is about four or five times the population of Tucson. And as Ron was mentioning, it is a Republican stronghold and has been for a very long time. Tucson is the smaller Democratic stronghold. And so early on, they really wanted to adhere to very strict messaging based on the polling data. And that polling data was telling them that words like justice, equality, and fairness were not going to work in Arizona. Mm-hmm. And they were particularly concerned that images of LGBTQ people and LGBT couples were abhorrent to voters. And so they stripped the campaign. We called it de-gaying the campaign. They essentially stripped the campaign of all LGBTQ references.
For a campaign that was meant to try to protect the rights of same-sex couples to get married.
Correct, yes. So the way they decided to strategize and message this was the proposition at that time was written not only as an anti-marriage equality, anti-LGBT, but it was also an anti-civil union. And so What they decided to do was to focus on how it would impact unmarried heterosexual, particularly senior citizens. And they put forward an image of a couple from south of Tucson and Green Valley called Al and Maxine, who would be affected by this. They would be unable, because they were in a civil union, to have hospital visitations because they were an unmarried heterosexual couple.
Mm. Okay, so Kent, hang on here for a second. Ron, let me turn back to you here for a little bit of broader context about the battle over Proposition 107 in Arizona. I mean, how would you describe What was that like? Were activists like Kent and lawmakers like Sinema facing an uphill battle in Arizona?
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. You know, this has been one of the issues nationally where public attitudes have changed, you know, in a pretty dramatic fashion in a relatively short period of time. In Arizona, there's really not been a great track record of success for liberal or left-leaning ideals being embraced at that point. So it's worth noting that the state was already showing sort of an interest in changing. In the early part of the 21st century, we see the state enact things like passing a bipartisan, independent-guided redistricting commission. It was one of the first to do that. Around this same time that she is fighting the Prop 107, there's also an effort to raise the state minimum wage. So Arizona was showing early signs of sort of being open to these kinds of ideals, but it's not like you had a lot of success that you could point to of ways that you could just be boldly to the left and win statewide.
Okay, so what Kent is describing, though, is what actually to me sounds like a very disciplined lawmaker who has a clear goal, right? Wanting to defeat Prop 107 and looking at the landscape before her across the state of Arizona and saying, tactically, if we want to win, we may have to do things that are distasteful to, you know, the very advocates who she was working alongside. Is that what that sounds like to you, Ron? And Kent, I'll get your take on this in just a second.
You're very observant, Magna. Yes, it does seem to be part of a pattern that would obviously follow her in some ways, that this is someone who is remarkably disciplined and able to stay on message relentlessly. That is obviously her pattern today as well, and it's something that I think has marked her career throughout, that there were a lot of opportunities where she might have gone in a different direction, chased her passion. Instead, she sort of tries to keep her eyes on what she really wants and is ruthless about trying to get to that point, even if it means sort of, being willing to change tactics in a way that might feel different than where perhaps her heart was initially.
Well, and at the risk of alienating the very people who are key parts of the same effort, right? So, Kent, what was the cost of, as you describe it, Sinema opting to, you know, quote unquote, de-gay the campaign?
Yeah, I think the cost was really high. And this is where Kyrsten Sinema and I had profound disagreements. I want to give her credit because as we were saying, her ruthlessly disciplined messaging in the end won this one battle, because in Arizona, they defeated the voters by a small margin, Proposition 107. But the cost is this: by de-gaying the campaign, the advocates in Tucson and activists were all concerned that we were doing nothing to advance the larger issues of LGBTQ equality, because her point would be that that doesn't resonate. But our point was, at some point, they're just going to come back with different language and they're going to win. And sure enough, 2 years later, Arizona passed Proposition 102, which was a much more narrower, focused only on LGBT people. And that one passed by the voters by a larger margin. And so we ended up losing the war in a way, even though she won one battle. And our concern was that she was not, by not being willing to talk about the real issues, right? This campaign was ultimately an anti-LGBT campaign. By not being willing to talk about that, she was doing nothing to advance our longer-term agenda. And I think this is an issue that I would say is concerning, in that she talks a lot, you know, in her book, subsequent, you know, this kind of launched her national campaign in many ways. It gave her a platform to talk about the success. And Unite and Conquer, her book, was very much about coalition building. I think our the issue that I have is that when you are working towards coalitions, you have to have a common shared goal. And in this case, I would argue that the message framing really wasn't about building a larger coalition. There was a larger coalition that could have been built. But even, Alan Maxine, this heterosexual senior couple, ultimately came out and said that LGBTQ equality in marriage is not their issue. Huh. That's not building a coalition, right? Mm-hmm. That's not building a group of people that have a common shared end result that they yeah. want to see.
You know, it is impossible to not wonder about the parallels between the experience that you're talking about in 2006, 2007, and now Senator Kyrsten Sinema's approach in the United States Senate. Because, Kent, you're describing a situation where it sounds like you were trying to convince Kyrsten Sinema that you might win this battle, but you're going to lose the war overall. And then 2 years later, when Prop 102 did pass, defining marriage as the union between one man and one woman in Arizona, mm-hmm. did you ever talk to her about that, that what you had foreseen actually took place? And if so, how did she respond?
You know, I did not. I need to be honest with you. Between those two periods, between 2006 and 2008, I did have conversations with her. She was invited, and this is what I meant by it kind of was a catapult for her onto a national stage, because she was invited to speak about the success of 107. And there were places where sometimes I would be at those events and have a smaller speaking role, but my message was consistently, this is not a long-term winning strategy. So I want to be clear, because she did win, right? It was the first state to win one of these propositions. So it's the hard thing with Kyrsten Sinema, because I have a lot of admiration and respect for her in many ways. She is very smart and a very good strategist, and she really does understand how to win. And at the same time, I actually found that she was kind of dismissive, right? She felt like she knew best how to approach things, and was somewhat dismissive of other viewpoints once she kind of sets her mind to a way to achieve something.
Well, Kent Burbank is chair of the LGBTQ Plus Alliance Fund of the Community Foundation for Southern Arizona, teaches social work at Pima Community College as well. And as we mentioned, he worked with Kyrsten Sinema from 2006 to 2007 as part of a group called Arizona Together, with us from Tucson today. Kent Burbank, that was absolutely fascinating. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
All right. Well, let's turn now briefly to Adam Gentleson. He is executive director of the Battleborn Collective, a progressive strategy and communications firm, former deputy chief of staff for then majority leader Harry Reid, and author of Kill Switch, The Rise of the Modern Senate. Adam, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you, Megan. It's great to be here.
So tell us what you think about the story Kent Burbank just told us, because he described actually quite a tactically savvy state-level lawmaker there in 2006. But again, he had warned her, you're going to win the battle over Prop 107, but you might lose the long-term war regarding, you know, the rights of the LGBT community in Arizona.
Yeah, it's a fascinating story. I listened raptly to that account, you know, and, you know, as I think Ken was careful to point out, there's certainly two sides to that, to the story. And it's easy to see her perspective as well as his. But what I think is really interesting about the way that Sinema has conducted herself over the last few months is it's far less clear now what the even tactical benefit of a lot of the things that she's doing is to her. And you know, I should be clear that I'm a very strong advocate of filibuster reform. That's, you know, a lot of what the book is about. But even if you pull back and sort of take my own, you know, issue preferences and ideological preferences out of the mix, just from a brass tacks political perspective, it's not clear, what benefits she is gaining from a lot of the things she's doing. It seems to be alienating a lot of her allies. It's hurt her approval ratings in the state. And it's just not, it's not clear what the constituency is for the type of performative bipartisanship that she seems set on pursuing.
Well, Ron, we've just got 30 seconds before we have to take a break here. Do you, have you been able to get an answer from Senator Sinema about who she thinks her perceived constituency is in the championing of bipartisanship?
She, I think, wants to say that she is representing all of Arizona and is trying to, you know, play the long game here, recognizing that the political winds can shift in a way that people don't always like.
Well, we're going to come back with a lot more about how Senator Sinema's political past now continues to inform her political present and the present and future of her party, the Democratic Party. So we'll be right back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're learning all we can about the political past and present of Arizona Senator Kyrsten Sinema, and therefore trying to understand what the future of her party, the Democratic Party, might be. I'm joined today by Ron Hansen. He covers Congress and state politics for the Arizona Republic and AZ Central. He's also co-host of the podcast The Gaggle. He's with us from Phoenix. Adam Gentleson is with us as well. He's former deputy chief of staff for then Majority Leader Harry Reid and author of Kill Switch, The Rise of the Modern Senate. And inevitably, we have arrived at the conversation over Senator Sinema's defense of the filibuster in the Senate. And last month, as she toured the United States-Mexico border and Border Patrol facilities alongside Texas Republican Senator John Cornyn, she was asked by reporters regarding her support of the filibuster.
As folks in Arizona know, I've long been a supporter of the filibuster because it is a tool that protects the democracy of our nation rather than allowing our country to ricochet wildly every 2 to 4 years back and forth between policies. The idea of the filibuster was to create comity and to encourage senators to find bipartisanship and work together. And while there are some who don't believe that bipartisanship is possible, I think that I'm a daily example that bipartisanship is possible.
Adam, I believe you take exception to Senator Sinema's historical analysis of the filibuster.
I do. It's just not accurate. You know, and I think her defense of the filibuster has been routinely characterized by these kind of misleading statements. You know, the filibuster wasn't created by the framers. In fact, the framers were very vehemently opposed to the filibuster or anything like it existing. They were very specific that they thought that if any sort of supermajority requirement or requiring more than a majority to pass things in the Senate existed, they predicted that it would lead to gridlock, just as we are seeing today. It didn't exist in the Senate for most of its existence. The Senate was a majority rule body for 200 years and has only really become a phenomenon in recent decades. So this idea that it is this historic you know, foundational element of the Senate is just simply not true. And it's not just me saying this. This is a widely accepted fact among historians and political scientists.
Well, so can I just turn back to Ron here for a second? Because Ron, again, I just want to give your podcast, The Gaggle, a great shout out. It's fantastic. But I was listening to a recent interview that you did with Senator Sinema from a couple of months ago, a little earlier this spring. And you and your co-host just flat out asked her if she's being naive about the possibility for bipartisanship and comedy in the Senate, which I thought was an excellent question, especially given the political savvy that she has historically shown, as we've talked about earlier in the show, given the fact that she's got, you know, an educational CV longer than my arm. And how did she respond to the question about, is she being naive about the possibility for comedy in the Senate?
She maintains that she thinks that bipartisanship still exists and that it's something that is a hard process that you can get if you're willing to do the work. And that's something that I think to a lot of folks these days, it just feels like it doesn't reconcile with their lived experience of contemporary politics. And I think that that's where this great tension lies at the moment, especially with Democratic and liberal activists, that she seems committed to an ideal that to them seems, antiquated, if not extinct.
But so, Adam, I mean, it that ideal may seem extinct, I would say, for a reason, because one of the things that she told Ron in that interview that he did with her is she went back to her notion about, you've got to change behavior in the Senate, right? Don't change the rules. Don't change the historic rules. Change the behavior of the people operating within those rules. But
yes.
but in the current Senate, where as you know, I mentioned earlier, Senator Mitch McConnell has repeatedly said his goal, as it was for the Obama administration, for the Biden administration, is to simply stop all the administration's agenda, where are the incentives at all for behavior change in the modern Senate?
That's exactly right. All the incentives for behavior change point into the exact opposite direction that she wants to move in. Republicans have enormous incentives not to cooperate with Democrats and enormous incentives to block President Biden's agenda. This is exactly what they did to President Obama. And, you know, I hate to say it, but it worked for them. It yielded enormous political gains for them, sad as it may be to say that. So I think it is a naive refusal to you know, open your eyes and look around and recognize the world that we live in, where Republicans simply have enormous incentives not to provide the 10 additional votes that Democrats need to pass anything through the filibuster. Mm. One irony is that the current 60-vote threshold is in many ways blocking bipartisanship. All you have to do is look at the vote, for instance, on the January 6th commission a few weeks ago, where 7 Republicans did actually cross over and vote with Democrats. But because, you know, that wasn't enough to get you to 60, that vote failed. So because of the existence of the filibuster, an opportunity for a bipartisan vote to establish a commission failed, you know, and if the filibuster didn't exist, this thing would have passed with 55, 56, 57 votes, and we would right now have a January 6th commission. So not only is it somewhat naive to expect frequent bipartisanship, in the rare instances where it does appear to be possible, the 60-vote threshold is preventing it from happening because it's just too high a hurdle to clear right now.
Mm-hmm. Well, so Ron Hansen, as we played some tape earlier regarding where Senator Sinema comes from in terms of her approach, there's another interesting layer we have to talk about. You mentioned it earlier, that it's not just, you know, how much is she willing to advance her party's agenda, but also the state that she represents. And so it's got to be part of her current political calculus to weigh what the cost would be if she just wholeheartedly said, well, let's abolish the filibuster. I mean, how would that go over in Arizona?
You know, I don't know. That's an interesting question, because I think that, you know, this is a state that continues to evolve. But mm-hmm. what we do know is that when she won in 2018, for example, she won by 2.3 percentage points. And it was the first time that a Democrat won a Senate race in Arizona in 30 years. When you look at Mark Kelly, who is her counterpart in the Senate from Arizona, you know, he won by 2.3 percentage points. And of course, everybody remembers that Joe Biden won Arizona last year, but it was by 0.3 percentage points. What you've got is what seems to be in some ways a recent track record of great success for Democrats in this state. And that is, you know, something that has emboldened folks on the left here to feel like they can win and they can get what they want, seemingly, But at the same time, the state legislature got more conservative. The night she was elected to the Senate, the gubernatorial Democratic candidate was wiped out by double digits. And so there is a relatively narrow path that has been shown to work in this state, but it's unclear as to just how far you can take it in the near term.
Yeah.
And I think that's part of what is guiding her deliberations on these issues.
Yeah. So, Adam, you used to work for Harry Reid, also from that area of the country. I genuinely want to know what you think about what good would it do the Democrats if Kyrsten Sinema, for example, decided to pivot and say, we're going to do that $15 minimum wage, we're going to abolish the filibuster, I'm going to fully embrace the, you know, the progressive desires of the party, and then she gets voted out by Arizona voters. So, I mean, this has to be part of the larger calculus here.
It certainly does. And I want to be realistic about the political, you know, realities that she faces and what you have to do to win in Arizona. But even by that metric, she is farther to the right than many other senators who come from even redder states. You know, I would point to someone like Senator John Tester from Montana, which Trump won by 16 points, who, you know, hasn't been an ardent advocate of filibuster reform, but has shown a very clear openness to it on a number of occasions and has taken a position of, you know, I don't want to do it. I'm not rushing to do it. But if it becomes necessary, I'm willing to consider reform. And so, you know, that's a senator who represents a state Trump won by 16 points. And Sinema represents a state that Biden won, albeit narrowly. So she's putting herself even further to the right than other senators who have much harder political realities back home. Senator Reid, you know, came from Nevada, which has been blue in the last few elections, but is still a swing state. His philosophy, and frankly, the way he won his last reelection race in 2010, was that you have to sort of dance, you know, with the folks that brung you. And, you know, he committed to the Democratic agenda. He committed to President Obama's agenda in a very strong way. And that caused there to be very high turnout in his reelection race, particularly among the Latino population in Nevada. Polls were showing him losing and he won unexpectedly. And so I think, you know, one way to approach these things, and certainly Mark Kelly, her fellow senator from Arizona, has been much more open to filibuster reform and other issues than she is. So it's, you know, even though Arizona is a narrow state, it is possible to support the Democratic agenda, and some would argue even more beneficial politically to, you know, show the people who put you in office and who knocked doors and donated to your campaign that you are going to support the policies that they want to see enacted.
Right. Well, we'll have to keep following this story, especially Ron. I'd love to have you back on the show to talk about how things play out in Arizona, whether or not Senator Sinema experiences any blowback, for example, for not showing up for the vote on the January 6th commission or not going to Vice President Harris's dinner, bipartisan dinner for women in Congress. But we'll stop this here for now. Ron Hansen covers Congress for the Arizona Republic. It was great to have you, Ron. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, Magna.
And by the way, do check out his podcast, The Gaggle. And Adam Gentleson, Executive Director of Battleborn Collective and author of Kill Switch. It was great to have you back, Adam. Thank you.
Great to talk to you again, Magna. Thank you.
Well, the American urge to constantly look forward, and yes, even as we just demonstrated right here on Point, can also lead to another American peculiarity, a collective historical amnesia, even for the most recent events. And we do not want to fall into that trap, especially as this country has gone through an historic pandemic, one that's not even over yet. So we have been reaching out to guests who joined us this past COVID year, and we've been asking them to reflect on where they were and where they are now. Adrienne Marie Brown is author of Pleasure Activism, The Politics of Feeling Good, and Emergent Strategy, Shaping Change and Changing Worlds. She joined us last year to talk about finding joy in the midst of overwhelming world events.
It is absolutely the normal thing right now to be grieving every day. Like, don't try to run away from that. Don't try to put joy on top of that. You can't deny it. Feel it and then adapt, right? Like, the adaptations I'm making are, I need to talk to my family every day. I want to see their faces every week. That's as much as we can do right now. Be with uncertainty, the small one step at a time. Be your best self. in that moment.
That was last year. We played the moment back to her recently, and here's how she reacted.
I definitely feel the wave of grief that moves through me, that's like been moving through and is still moving through in that moment. And I feel a little gratitude listening to it because I'm like, oh, yes, like I have been in such good contact with my family and my loved ones. This past year has been a year of realizing how much we matter to each other and taking it seriously. I'm grateful I said that. Yes, that's how I feel. And that's what I've been practicing.
She shared what this past year has been like for her.
I've been astounded by how much joy I've received from being in closer contact with my family. We are still doing a weekly call with each other, and often the children get on, my little nibblings get on, and just being able to see their faces, see them growing, see them changing, and all of us like learning how to share so much more of our lives with each other. We've always been a close family, loved each other, but now it's different when you're in a rhythm of weekly visual contact, right? With anyone. It's like, oh, what's happening with your, you know, spirit? What's happening with your health? Like, how's the house? You know, you start to have a better intimate sense of each other. My uncle, he went to Jamaica with his girlfriend and some friends, and they came back and 3 out of 4 of them were sick with COVID and he passed away. So that was really difficult, you know, directly like, oh, I don't get to be with him. I don't get to see him again. And then knowing the impact that has on my family, that moment was a really hard one. Even under duress, there's still a choice available of feeling our feelings, but then, you know, circling back around to, okay, and then where's the aliveness in this moment? What's possible still for me in this moment? And sometimes the aliveness is just, I have a shoulder to cry on. Thank God for that. I worked hard for that, you know, and I have people who really love and care about me outside of anything that happens on the internet. That is really helpful. It actually brings me joy to just sit sometimes and reflect on who's in my life right now. I'll share one more thing, which is we've been just literally walking around the block, like going outside to walk around the block. And I have early onset arthritis that is, you know, can be very debilitating. So when we were first trying to, you know, I was first trying to figure out like, I need to get more exercise. I need to do stuff with my body. And I was really like, oh, I can, you know, I started tracking my steps and I'm like, I am struggling to get 500 steps right now. And in my mind, I had that thing of like, you're supposed to get 10,000 steps a day. That's how you stay healthy forever. And I was like, I can't get 500. And now I'm up to almost 5,000 a day. And the joy every time I walk outside and I'm like, okay, I can add another block. We can add another length of the street, you know, I'm like, maybe it'll still be possible for me to be in nature the way I love, right? I go with my sweetheart, my fiance. I guess that's something you don't know since last time I was on the show is I experienced a very romantic proposal and I said yes to that. So yeah, my fiance. You know, I don't know anyone who could truly make it through this pandemic all by themselves. However you're in contact, however you're finding a relationship, like it feels so important, so clearly important to have your people.
That's Adrian Marie Brown, author of Pleasure Activism, The Politics of Feeling Good, and Emergent Strategy, Shaping Change, Changing Worlds. In the coming weeks, we will continue to be talking with more On Point guests who joined us over this past year about what that experience has been like for them and their thoughts about COVID, about this country, and their lives now. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.